World. I'm John Bash with Professor Peter Stansky of Stanford University, discussing his new book, The Socialist Patriot, George Orwell in War. George Orwell is world famous, solar system famous for two books, 1984 and Animal Farm. Before that, however, there was the evolution of a novelist and a journalist and an essayist and a book reviewer and an editor. The literary life as it was lived between the First War and the Cold War. And right now we're in that period early on when George Orwell has come back from Spain, not disillusioned, but lucky to have survived. He's with Eileen, who is very good to him and inspirational in some instances, because the animals in Animal Farm, naming them and making characters out of them, that is Eileen's imagination at a little farmhouse they lived in when they were first married, calling the pigs and the chickens different names. But in any event, George Orwell, a.k.a. Eric Blair, gets caught up in writing about the working class. And, Professor, it is very revelatory that throughout his life he was keen on class. He was resentful of and at the same time fascinated by it. And his Etonian accent always gave him away when he did his research in down and out in Paris and on the road to Wigan Pier. I've never heard his voice. Is there a recording of his voice anywhere?
I don't think so. I mean, you think there would be, because he did all these broadcasts during the Second World War, which have been, and most of them have been published. And, you know, there's the great multi-volume edition of Orwell, edited by the just recently deceased Peter Davison, which, you know, a treasure trove. But as far as I know, I may be wrong, I don't think I've ever heard his voice.
But it did, give him away to the working class. Did they resent him when they heard, realized that he was that Etonian?
No. I think actually they were sympathetic. I think I have a feeling maybe he says something about that and down and out in Paris and London. You know, poor old chap. He's fallen on hard times. I don't think he ever had any resentment. And I probably sort of, I mean, as far as I know, he didn't try. He'd like to have certain working class habits, which amused his friends because they thought, you know, they didn't really work, about how you drank your tea and how you ordered things in a pub and things like that. You know, there's some feeling he might have wanted to be a member of the working class, but I somehow doubt it. But on the same time, he's tremendously sympathetic, and it's during the war that he writes in a way of rather almost romantic, during the Second World War, that he writes almost in a romantic way about the English working class and about the English state. You know, we have, I don't know, we want to talk later about the Second World War, but he published this tremendously influential pamphlet, influential in the sense of shaping his ideas, and it had some, it was quite popular. But it had this wonderful title, which I think encapsulated his attitude. The Lion and the Unicorn is its chief title, which, of course, are the heraldic beasts on the royal coat of arms, : Socialism and the English Genius. And which he argues that it turned out incorrectly, that Britain would have to make itself a socialist society immediately in order to win the war. But of course, that didn't happen. Later on, of course, there was the welfare state.
There are contradictions, perhaps because the words that he's using have had their meanings changed in America. I wrote down this one sentence, wrote Orwell, this is during the run. Well, England's in the war in 39, long before the U.S. is. But he writes, it is only by revolution that the native genius of the English people can be set free. What did he mean by that, Professor?
Well, he I think it's a little hard to tell. He, you know, as I say, part of his patriotism, he felt that he felt that the English people, which was the name of a little book that he wrote during the war, but wasn't published until after the war, that socialism would somehow take make the virtues of English more evident, and you know that the working class, which in his view was innately a good group, the oppression of them would cease, and they would be able to realize themselves better. He made all these predictions, about most of which were inaccurate, of what Britain would be like after the Second World War. For instance, he predicted that the public schools, such as his own school, Eton, would cease to exist, which, of course, is far from true. And, of course, there's a great irony that he seriously considered putting down his adopted son for Eton, sending him to Eton. At the same time, I mean, one of the themes, I think, of British history, which is not particularly part of Orwell, but is that British institutions and the monarchy, of course, is an example, and what's going to happen with the monarchy is a question of interest now, is British institutions such as Eton are incredibly capable of making extraordinary changes in order to remain the same, as much the same as they were in the past. And they're flexible and adaptable and preserve themselves. And I don't think Orwell, although he says, I think the public schools shouldn't exist, I don't think he believed that very strongly. And of course, it didn't happen.
His work for the BBC, 1941 to 1943, his job was for the Eastern version, that means the broadcast out to the empire, India, the subcontinent. But he gathered together the leading literary names of the time. I jotted down a few of them. He met Arthur Kessler, T.S. Eliot, all of the English writers he gathered in. With a friend of his, they found a publishing called Searchlight Books. So at this point, he's moving from being a writer who's looking to make a name for himself into a mentor of other writers? Is that how I should understand him during the war, a mentor?
No, I don't think a mentor. I mean, these were very senior people, T.S. Eliot, William Emerson. He had dealings with E.M. Forster. I think he was a colleague. They were senior to him. I mean, there were younger people as well, but to them he might play a mentor role. But I think it was an interchange. I think they valued what he wrote, and they valued his opinion. And he interestingly became friends with people who were more politically conservative than he was. Andy Powell, the novelist, became a good friend. Malcolm Muggeridge became a good friend. He's always been a figure of, he wasn't an unknown figure. He was a fairly well-known novelist in the 30s, but not a major novelist. He became more a senior figure. And so in a sense, he might have been a mentor to younger people. But I don't think it was really his, listen to what I say, read what I write. If you find it valuable, good. I don't think he was a mentor. I don't think it's quite the right word. I think colleague would be better.
Anti-governing elite. That was clear repeatedly through the Second War. He also speculates, if the ordinary English can get their hands on power, is that his idea of socialism, ordinary English being authorities?
Yes, I think so. I think so. I haven't quite thought about it in that way.
Because that's what's happened.
But he also recognized leadership. I mean, he had doubts about Churchill. He wanted Stafford Cripps, who was more to the left, to have more power. But Cripps himself was very grand, Beatrice Webb's nephew, a wealthy man in his own right. I think he, well, it's interesting. I mean, I don't think he really believed in the destruction of the British class system. But he certainly believed that the upper classes should be less powerful and the working classes should be more powerful. And the welfare state, which he approved of, you know, when 1984 was published, he had to issue denials. He said, I'm a firm supporter, though he wasn't a member, I'm a firm supporter of the Labour Party, and I'm a firm supporter of socialism, because particularly in America, 1984 was taken as a very anti-socialist book. It's anti-communist, it's anti-Russia, but it's definitely not anti-socialist. So you know, he thought that the working class should be more powerful, I think he felt there should be more cooperation between classes, and the upper classes should become less powerful, even though he himself was a member of them.
He resigns from the BBC in November of 43, leaves the Home Guard at the same time, perhaps for health reasons. But in any event, he was despairing of the Home Guard because they never actually practiced anything. It was a social club. And he begins Animal Farm, November of 43. I said before Eileen was an inspiration to him for having named animals on their idyllic farm. Animal Farm is challenging because it makes it very clear that socialism turns in or can turn into authoritarianism. Is that the message he wanted to convey? That socialists must be careful.
Not so much. It's not socialism. Socialism, in his view, is a definite good. What he argues, and I think correctly, is the evil thing is power, and that the people who create the revolution, a revolution, socialist revolutions, for good reasons, come into power and then are determined to maintain their power, and in the process destroy the socialism that they themselves have created. And he's despairing. He's not, he's pessimistic. He's both pessimistic and somewhere, but then he also, the solution he feels, and I think he's correct about this, the solution he feels, and, you know, it doesn't actually, unfortunately, doesn't happen, is that there should be a frequent change of leaders. If there were a frequent change of leaders, then socialism might maintain itself. But it's the... you know, the famous aphorism of Lord Acton, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And he certainly believed in that.
The war ends at the death of Eileen in March of 45 during an operation that was not meant to be mortal. He's now a widower with an adopted son. Soon enough, his older sister is also to die, and he takes on their two children and moves to...
No, he doesn't look after them. I think it's more his brother-in-law. He's in close touch with them.
He moves to the Inner Hebrides, an island called Jura in Scotland, and many people come to visit him. So it's time to turn to the Cold War, which follows immediately upon the Second War's end. The book is The Socialist Patriot, George Orwell and War. Peter Stansky, professor at Stanford University, is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Radcliffe.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.